Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If you've ever been inside a radio sound studio, you might be able to picture where I'm sitting right now. The room has a desk with microphones, a clock, gray walls, gray carpet, big heavy soundproof door. The room is pretty boring, to be honest, but the idea is to help me do what is increasingly challenging in today's world, to really focus on just this one thing for 2 hours every day. And yet, I've got a computer monitor in here to see calls coming in, an iPad to check emails and Twitter. It still takes some effort to pay attention. Humans are wired to focus intently on what is really important as a matter of survival. Since we don't often have to dodge predators or hunt for food these days, though, we can find it all too easy to squander our attention surfing the web or shooting aliens or flipping channels, sometimes simultaneously. But as we'll discuss with my guest, the sum of all the small rewards derived from those diversions are not equal to what we can get from thinking deeply and working slowly and sometimes physically to master a skill that contributes to both our own lives and to the broader society. Matthew B. Crawford is senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and a fabricator of components for custom motorcycles. His new book is called The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Matthew, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The standard way of thinking these days is that our attention problems must be a result of all our technology. But you trace the origins of this way, way back to Enlightenment thinkers. What does their definition of autonomy have to do with the way the world looks today?
Well, you're going straight to the the crux of it. In the air very much is this question of whether one can maintain a coherent self against all these distractions. I mean, a self that can kind of act according to settled purposes and ongoing projects instead of flitting around. And so we reach for ideas that are kind of ready at hand in the culture, and one of those is freedom. And that makes sense because we often feel like our attention is being appropriated by external forces, and that's often for commercial purposes. So it's quite natural to sort of think, don't tread on me, to borrow that political motto. But then there's other in addition to those unwanted intrusions, we also have diversions that we willingly invite into our lives, whether it's Candy Crush or porn or whatever it may be. And we find these no less disturbing, because they seem to crowd out other forms of engagement with our surroundings and with other people. But on this front, it seems like there's nobody to blame but ourselves. And so we end up reaching for another kind of classic idea in Western culture, which is self-control. It seems like strategies for self-regulation are having a renaissance right now that's unprecedented in mass culture. I mean, that's an idea. That sort of ascetic idea we associate with the monastic tradition, not consumer capitalism. But I think those two ideas of freedom and self-control come together in the idea of autonomy that you mentioned.
I mean, autonomy assumes that we are free from control by other people, but it also assumes that we are free to do what we want. And that's where I guess the self-control aspect of it comes in.
Yeah, I think the basic idea, literally, the word means giving a law to yourself, as opposed to having your actions determined by something external to the self. And I think the concept of autonomy captures something important in a life well lived, and that becomes most clear in its absence. So think of the drug addict. On the one hand, in shooting up, he's doing what he wants to do. He's free. But on the other hand, he answers to a compulsion that he experiences as a sort of alien force. So he lacks autonomy, which is this more rigorous understanding of freedom that comes to us from certain thinkers.
Go ahead, please.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask what it takes to determine for ourselves what is important and what deserves our attention.
Well, that's really the crux of it. I think Our distractibility could be taken as an indication that we're agnostic on the question of what's worth paying attention to. that is what to value. And so to answer that question freely requires shelter. It requires a kind of space for seriousness that you have to carve out for yourself. But my sense is that we're not going to be able to kind of self-regulate our way out of mental fragmentation, nor liberate our way out of it by, you know, somehow sealing ourselves off from the world. The remedy, rather, I think, is to become absorbed in some worthy object that has intrinsic appeal and elicits our involvement in a way that kind of brings our mental energies to a point.
So in other words, what we decide to focus on and what really engages us forces us by its nature to ignore some other things.
Yeah, I think once you do become absorbed in something, that burden of self-regulation is really much lighter. It almost goes away. And I think to get absorbed in something feels more like abandon than self-control, or more like surrender than liberation. I sometimes think the language of eroticism is better suited to parse that experience than the language of asceticism or sort of liberation from something external.
So you are an interesting figure in that you, of course, are a member of the Academy, but you also work on motorcycles and you make these custom parts. What is the particular appeal of working with your hands, and what do you get from that that you don't get from the very challenging and engaging process of, say, writing a book?
I guess I would start more with similarities in that both I'm trying to get something right. You know, when I make parts for bikes, they have to fit right. And in writing a book, I'm trying to not just express myself, but to capture something about the world and really understand it. So in both activities, I guess I'd say that I'm answering to standards that are external to myself. So I'm getting sort of pulled out of myself. And you neither of these kinds of work could you do while remaining kind of self-absorbed in your own fantasies. And so really I think that's one of the kind of appealing things about work, is that it forces you to kind of triangulate off other people and get back a reflected view from them of yourself and of your own take on the world. And so it's a kind of antidote for self-absorption, I guess.
Does our freedom to engage in whatever we think is important to us, does it carry with it an implied obligation to other people or to the community?
Well, certainly one could get absorbed in better and worse activities, some that might be socially pernicious and others that might sort of reverberate outward into the community in ways that kind of enhance our common life together. So one of the examples I talk about in the book is these craftspeople who build pipe organs. And for them, their work of building these organs is, you know, very absorbing. They get sort of pulled into all the technical details of it. And that can become a kind of obsessive thing. But they're building these organs mostly for churches. So they're kind of, these organs assume a place in the life of a congregation. They play an organ repertoire that goes back hundreds of years. And the organ itself becomes a kind of focal point for a whole community. And that seems to give the work of the organ makers a kind of meaning that would be hard to find, I think, in building widgets of some unspecified kind, because the sort of the end served by the widget, in this case the organ, is itself something kind of beautiful and something that they're able to affirm. So contrast, you know, maybe a gunsmith who fashions a satiny, smooth trigger action on a gun. He might equally get absorbed in what he's doing. But if that gun is for a mob hitman, let's say, then it's we want to say that he has a kind of myopic focus on his craft, that there's something gone wrong there.
In terms of the sort of symbolic importance of these things, I was struck by the fact that somebody that you interviewed said that it costs about twice as much to restore an old pipe organ as it would to rip the old thing out and put in a brand new one. And yet many, many, you know, church congregations in this case are more interested in having the old one restored.
Yeah, I think it becomes part of their sort of their collective and institutional memory. It's connected to the generations that might have been attending that church. And I think a lot of people want to sort of reclaim things from the past because they do have that significance. And one of the interesting things I found in talking to these organ makers is that they're working in this very long tradition of making pipe organs that goes back about 400 years, but they don't seem to feel burdened by this tradition. It's more like they feel energized by it. And in fact, it's not simply a kind of antiquarian reverence for the old. They're engaged in this quarrel with the old organ builders. They, you know, they kind of take those old organs apart and reverse engineer them, and they see, you know, something could have been done better here. So they're always pushing the state of the art further ahead. So it's really a living tradition as opposed to a dead tradition. And where that really came through was talking to one guy who's does the voicing, which is the minute adjustments on the organ pipes to get them to sound just right. And he just in an offhand way mentioned that he expects this organ that he's working on to still be in service 400 years from now. And that kind of blew my mind, that these are not, they're not simply looking backward, they're really looking forward.
But of course they have to, in order to make things better than they've ever been, they have to understand the way they've been done in the past, which is not something at this moment in time that our culture seems particularly focused on.
Yeah, and I think that is part of our Enlightenment heritage, where the past is seen as just a limitation on who you could be, sort of potentially. So there's this idea that really begins with Descartes and Locke, that that you have to stand on your own two feet and reject custom or example and kind of build up from scratch your own foundation for thinking and reject anything that looks like authority, especially the kind of authority that operates in communities. And I think this leaves us feeling isolated and kind of also more manipulable by whatever, you know, sort of by the present, in other words, by whatever kind of blandishments are offered in popular culture.
We're speaking this hour with Matthew B. Crawford. He's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, and he's a fabricator of components for custom motorcycles. He also has a new book out called The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. We'd love to hear your experiences with maintaining your coherent self in this age of distraction. You can tell us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies, offering evening programs for a Master of Liberal Studies and the new Doctor of Liberal Studies degree. You can design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU this fall. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew B. Crawford, a fabricator of components for custom motorcycles and senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture. His new book is called The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Matthew, one big challenge in the modern era is that sometimes the kind of attention that ultimately pays the greatest dividends is initially vastly less rewarding than other things that offer these quick little dopamine squirts. So if I play Candy Crush, it's typically more fun than taking a piano lesson, but 1,000 piano lessons makes me a musician, and 1,000 hours playing Candy Crush adds up to nothing but wasted time.
Yeah, I think that gets at something really important. So let me just give my own sort of example of just that. 20 years ago when I was in grad school, I would sometimes spend 10 or even 12 hours at the library at a stretch, only getting up from my chair to go get some food from the cafeteria once in a while. Whereas now I open a challenging book, and after a page, I feel like I'm kind of getting antsy. I start to drum my fingers on the table, and then I realize, oh, it is Tuesday night. My favorite TV show is on, and so I go and watch that, and then and maybe that's for the best, because then I have some basis for chit chat with other people the next day. I'm not a freak. In grad school, I felt disconnected from the surrounding culture, and now I like to think I'm pretty hip. And if I'd gotten absorbed in, say, Aristotle last night, my head would still be turning in this kind of spiral of strange thoughts that would sound strange anyway to my acquaintances. But what this means, I think, is that we're becoming more similar to one another. I think there's a big cultural consequence to our ability to concentrate on things that aren't immediately engaging, or our lack of that ability, and that is the persistence of intellectual diversity. To insist on the importance of trained powers of concentration, I think, is to recognize that independence of thought is a fragile thing and requires certain conditions. So you gave the example of learning to play the piano. I think I like that example because in order to express the sort of creativity of being a musician, you first have to spend hours and hours just practicing scales, and it's not appealing. And when we're constantly being addressed with sort of hyper-palatable mental stimuli, it becomes very hard to do that.
Should we be especially worried about the digital natives who don't even have, like, an analog childhood to reflect on and, you know, romanticize, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I don't know how much of this to pin on the technology itself. It almost seems more, part of it is the intent behind it. And sometimes the intent is manipulative. I think the media have become masters at packaging stimuli in ways that our brains find irresistible, just like food engineers figured out how to create hyper-palatable foods by manipulating levels of sugar and fat and salt. So distractibility might be regarded as sort of the mental equivalent of obesity. And it does seem that the palatability, if you will, of certain kinds of mental stimulation is hardwired, just like our taste for sugar, fat, and salt. And when you inhabit a highly engineered environment, the natural world, to say nothing of musty old books, starts to seem bland and tasteless, you know, like broccoli compared to Cheetos. Stimulation begets a need for more stimulation, and without it, you do feel kind of antsy and unsettled, almost hungry.
So if this is not about self-discipline, then what does it take? What separates the people who reach for the broccoli instead of the Cheetos?
Right. Well, Yeah, I think to simply berate yourself, I should eat more broccoli, is unlikely to be very effective. So if we can switch metaphors here, maybe. Let's go back to your example of playing piano. It does require self-regulation to get that process started. In other words, you have to be able to actively exclude all the other things that are grabbing at your attention and that are more immediately appealing. But I think once you do get a certain way into that it takes on a life of its own, and it does feel more like, the pleasure of playing the piano starts to come to the fore at some point, if you persist at it long enough. And I think that's the thing to focus on, because things that have intrinsic appeal like that provide a source of positive energy. And I find that a more promising sort of remedy for distraction than self-control.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Francisco in Dallas. Hi, Francisco.
Hi, Chris. What an excellent conversation. I'm just really curious about the author Matthew's thoughts about a particular book that I read that was important to me. I guess I should really not pose it as a question, but Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I read that as a teenager and was just so moved by the idea of finding the Buddha in simple things like repairing a bike, you know. And I'm curious about also what that means today in an age of push notifications. You know, our phones are constantly distracting us, constantly interrupting our days with feeds. And I think there's going to be a cultural consequence to that we're not going to be people with strong minds anymore, but very distractible. So anyway, that's just my thought about that. But thank you for the excellent show.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, so... I read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance halfway through twice. I think I read the first half of it twice. It was a great book. I don't recall this business about the Buddha, finding the Buddha, but what was the rest of the question?
I guess just, you know, I'm guessing that Francisco was saying it was very important to him and that, yeah. You know, again, he's concerned, as you are, that we might end up just being too easily distracted by things. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your own sort of how you found your way. Did your interest in also working with your hands come as a result of your study of philosophy, or... did you form your philosophy based on your experience in working with your hands?
Yeah, more the latter. So, you know, I studied physics as an undergrad and held a number of jobs. Eventually, I found my way to grad school and got into philosophy, but it was very different stuff. It was ancient Greek thought. And again, tried... working a job that I got with my PhD and hated it, and found myself going back to mechanical work. And so at some point, I was trying to figure out, why does this kind of work appeal to me more than the kind of work that I'm supposed to want to do? And that's when I got interested in a kind of trying to unpack that experience of agency, of having a direct effect on the world and being able to actually see that effect, trying to understand that philosophically. So I came to the philosophy of this stuff kind of backward, or, you know, from life, not vice versa.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Chip in Dallas. Hello, Chip.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
I used to be extremely distracted by everything. And a quote I heard one time that I shared with the screener was, if I'm not careful, I'll find myself being consumed by the wreckage of my future. Mm-hmm. So what I do is, on a daily basis, I get up every single morning, and there's a little meditation period, and I set my compass, and I set my beam, and I go out, and I throughout the day, you know, I adjust as I need to adjust, but, you know, I don't Facebook, and I don't tweet, and I don't, you know, Snapchat or any of these other number of myriads of things. In fact, I think right now my email's probably got several hundred, if not a thousand or so emails that I don't go deal with because they're all junk and they're all spam. And by stripping it down like that, I find it really easier to stay focused on the moment and to just simply, you know, deal with the task at hand and not be consumed by the records of my future. It's a great program and it's a great topic.
Thanks so much for your call, Chip. Is there anything, Matthew, that you heard there that you want to respond to?
Well, I mean, I think it's a nice indication that everybody is looking for little techniques or strategies to try to deal with this. And meditation is probably a promising one. I have yet to really delve into that, and but simply because I haven't gotten around to it. But you know, it is a kind of a discipline where you're, as I understand it, trying to sort of clear the mind. I guess a meditation where the point is to focus inside, that sounds really hard to me. I mean, I've tried to do that without a whole lot of success. Where I've had more success is focusing on something outside that it's not so much that it quiets the mind as that it means that I'm grappling with something that it gets you out of your head in a way. And so maybe it's a similar effect from an opposite angle.
And of course, this is not strictly about working or even processing thought in solitude. There is the example of, say, jazz musicians who have to know what they're doing and have to listen incredibly carefully and sort of be in musical dialogue with one another in order to create anything on their own.
Yeah, I really like that example. So in any kind of music that's improvisational, so jazz, but also like classical Indian music and bluegrass, everyone is attending to one another very intensely, and so it's a nice example of what I call an ecology of attention. And they're also steeped in these forms that are part of their aesthetic tradition. So, you know, a masterful jazz musician can quote from the real book, which is this sort of book of canonical tunes, and he can allude to it. And the illusion will be, you know, might be taken up and commented on by the other players and pushed forward towards something new that didn't even exist moments before because it only comes into being through the improvisation itself. And one reason I like that example is that we often think of creativity as something that just kind of erupts from the inner self. And that you, in order to be creative, you have to get free of the kind of authority that operates in communities. But what you find here is almost the opposite, that it's only sort of by being part of this community of jazz that you have something worthwhile to do. So I like it because it's it kind of points up the social nature of a skilled practice, the kind that's sufficiently absorbing that it does kind of pull you out of your own head.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Elizabeth in Fort Worth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I had a question for the author. I really like the subject of the show today, and I was just wondering if he thinks there's any correlation between the rise in distractibility that we're seeing in our culture and also the rise in people's desire to remain anonymous when they're either posting things or making comments about topics or people online. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, well, I haven't thought about that. Problem with having a microphone in front of you is that you feel invited to be to comment on everything.
That's why you're here. Go for it.
Right. It's just standing invitation to become a blowhard. But okay.
Now you're improvising your ideas here is what you're doing.
All right. An anonymity, yeah. I guess I haven't participated in social media myself, but maybe she's referring to sort of the comment culture in a thread, like after an article or something like that. I learned early on to never ever look at the comment section. I mean, it's kind of been pointed out by people that somehow the internet brings out the worst in people, and anonymity seems to make that possible because you don't feel like you're actually responsible for what you say, and you're not seeing face to face the effects of your words on people. And so there's that. I don't know if that bears on our larger theme or not. So I'll leave it at that.
Why have you not? You say you haven't participated in social media. Are you just afraid of where that will lead you, or it just doesn't interest you?
Well, I mean, I can see I've been tempted at times. I talk to people who get engaged in interesting conversations online. I guess, I mean, part of it is just very simple. I could see it becoming a real time sink, precisely because it is can be quite interesting. And but I also think there's some subtle ways it tends to shape the way people think, or at least the things they express. I mean, in posting something online, you kind of want to get back some love from people. You want to, you know, want people to like you. And I think that tends toward kind of saying things that you think are going to be popular. So I do, my sense is that there is a kind of conformity that is encouraged by social media, but that's more something I'm hearing from other people who know more about it.
Matthew B. Crawford is my guest. He's senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, also a fabricator of components for custom motorcycles. His new book is called The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the new SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program for Dallas community leaders and professionals. Now accepting applications for fall. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matthew B. Crawford, senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and author of the new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. You can join us by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk about a little bit about your subtitle, Becoming an Individual. By definition, aren't we all individuals, Matthew, even if we're, highly conformist and we sort of do what the people around us do? Is there something disingenuous about sort of making this requirement that individuality demands some kind of positive action in a unique direction?
Well, certainly the case that we all differ. We live in a culture where individualism is pretty much the reigning idiom we have for self-understanding. And it's also an aspiration we have to be authentic, as a word you often hear. And the way we understand that is that it requires don't simply replicate society or the life and world of your parents. And we sometimes feel that as a burden, and we feel inadequate, like we're not living up to this very heroic idea of being an individual. And when I talk about becoming an individual, I'm kind of going in the opposite direction. I'm saying that we really need other people to become an individual. Let me say what I mean by that. I mean to kind of earned independence of judgment, and an earned independence, let's say, of sort of affective or emotional responses to things. And the reason we need other people is that they serve kind of as a mirror for ourselves, and we can kind of triangulate off other people to modify our own take on things. And if you don't have that feedback from the world and from other people, it's easy to have a kind of self-aggrandized image of yourself as that's putting it too strongly, I guess. It's easy to kind of not have a secure feel for yourself. And this is kind of vague what I'm trying to get at here. But I do think interacting with objects and with other people can help us triangulate in a way that makes puts self-knowledge on a more secure footing. And it's only by bumping up against things and other people that our understanding of things can mature and deepen. So in that sense, I think we do need other people to achieve individuality.
Is some level of that kind of self-knowledge available to us throughout our lives? Or, like, is it impossible before we hit 30 and have seen enough of the world and interacted with enough people and objects?
Well, if I were to say yes, all of your under 30 listeners would send you angry emails. Yeah, I haven't thought of it in terms of life stage, but I do think that if a life goes well, then in the course of it, your understanding of, say, friendship is different at age 40 than it was at age 16. There's a kind of ripening and deepening that only comes from experience. I think when we talk about individuality, we're getting at something like that. It's tied to a particular biography and a set of experiences that forms you. And one of the key ideas in this book is that of the situated self, as I call it. And I'm simply trying to get at this fact that we are formed by our interactions with our environment. And so I think it's kind of a mistake to focus on this inner self that somehow exists prior to or at a deeper level than the self that is in the world.
To the extent that skilled practice changes the way we use our attention, is it okay if the focus of that attention changes over time? If, you know, for 10 years of your life, you are, you know, raising horses, and for 10 years of your life, you're really interested in painting, and for 10 years, you want to, you know, build small cabins, that sort of thing.
Well, I think that's quite natural. We grow and we take on new challenges. And then on the other hand, it's also true that to get good at something just takes a long time. And so maybe it's a question of where the sort of sweet spot is, because it's only when you start to get good at something that certain pleasures sort of come into view that you maybe weren't even aware of at earlier stages in your development. Personally, I've tended to move on without ever developing total mastery of anything. So far that's been fine. I mean, life is short. I mean, there is something sort of narrow and cramped about a person who does only one thing, even if they are the very best at it. So I don't have any sort of prescription on this question.
What are the consequences of the fact that at least in the United States, we tend to use consumption as a form of self-expression and very seldom even think to question that.
Right. So in shopping, you're choosing among all these things that are presented to you. And this sort of the choosing self is in a way at the heart of the anthropology of of the West, we regard freedom as something that manifests as somebody satisfying their preferences. And I'm kind of trying to shift the focus from freedom, thus understood, to agency, that is doing stuff, and to shift from choosing to skill. Because, well, for one thing, to understand yourself that way as you know, someone whose freedom is realized through exercising choice, for one thing, that kind of lays you bare to all manner of manipulative forces. So autonomy talk has really become the idiom of marketing, right? So
have it your way.
Have it your way, right? There's on the escalator at O'Hare Airport, there's a stickers applied to the handrail that say, "You're in charge." And that's just so typical and ubiquitous. So autonomy talk sometimes, you know, is sort of a sly way to try to get you to buy something. And the reason that it's effective is that it does tap into this a certain notion of freedom that we have, where freedom is something we're entitled to, and it it means being free from all the sort of limitations that your circumstances might place on you. So the credit card offer says, you know, no limits. And I'm so my idea of the situated self is really meant as a counter to that, that it's actually those limitations that provide the framing conditions for the kind of discipline that's required to go deep into something, the kind of thing that can really gather your mental energies to a point. And when that does happen, all those sort of proliferating choices tend to disappear. And time seems to dilate and become something to savor. So, yeah.
Do we focus too much on innovation in this culture to the extent that we often don't worry so much about understanding the long history or the background? We just figure, okay, get me up to speed so that I can do something that no one else has done before. I mean, do we do that at our peril?
Well, certainly there's the peril of reinventing the wheel.
The wheel is perfectly good.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of technological progress, so-called, doesn't really strike you as progress if you're sort of deeply immersed in some previous iteration of it. You can see that a lot of it is just kind of hype. And there seems to be this fetish of the new that often isn't really answering to functional standards. It's answering to some other thing that's going on. Sometimes there's a fetish of automaticity and disconnection. So I talk about contemporary automobiles and how they insulate us from the road. So quite apart from sort of bona fide safety innovations like airbags and anti-lock brakes, there's all this other stuff that the point just seems to be to make you as disconnected from the road as possible. And it's hard to understand that as technological progress if by technology you simply mean a set of functional standards. And then it seems to there's a weird ideology of technology where somehow we're more free if we're more disconnected. We're more free if things don't require any kind of skillful engagement on our part. And I think this leaves people feeling bereft, feeling like they're the occasions for skillful action in the world are just fewer and far between. And if you don't feel that you're actually responsible for your own physical environment, then I think you know, it's easy to sort of check out and become absorbed in a virtual world where you're offered a fantasy of agency. Yeah, so there's that.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ken on the line in Dallas. Hey, Ken.
Hello. Yes, a wonderful discussion. I'm over 60, but
the really interesting part is that is at 18 when I was in the military and I could fix anything, I found that out. I actually took a lot of pleasure from that. When I processed out of the military, the shrinks actually said, "You actually, there's something wrong with you. You get too much pleasure out of working with your hands, and you have to do it all by yourself." And now, through the years, I got where I was more of a team player. And now that I'm over 60, I don't need anybody. I can do it all myself. So it's kind of funny how it all cycles back around. But I was just wondering, psychologically, why would the military guy say there's something wrong with you if you get pleasure from fixing things?
That's an interesting question. Matthew, any thoughts?
I couldn't answer it. It does sound a little suspicious. I mean, it sounds like what the guidance counselor might say to a high school kid. you know, get with the program. I'm thinking of like Nurse Ratched here, who, you know, yeah. So that right, there's this imperative that everyone should somehow get hustled into the cubicle. And I actually taught high school for a year, so I can I know a little bit about this. And I'll just admit that there were times when I wish I had a Ritalin fogger in my classroom just to maintain order. And so I understand the problem. I think the problem is that it's a rare person who's naturally inclined to sit still for 16 years in school and then indefinitely at work. And yet this has become the sort of one-size-fits-all norm in education, even as we go on about diversity in education. We don't do a very good job of accommodating the diversity of learning styles. And for some of us, including some who are plenty smart, learning by doing is really the best way.
Would it make sense to you to put like 15-year-old apprentices in, you know, workshops and offices around the country?
It makes total sense. We've got, you know, childhood labor laws, which, you know, served an important function for us at a certain stage in history. But I started working as an electrician's helper when I was 14. And, man, I'm so glad that I got the chance to do that. I worked at a Porsche garage when I was 15. I think, you know, even all the way through university, education is this kind of youth subculture that's totally cut off from the adult world. And, you know, once people graduate from the university, then they have to get a job, and it's a rude shock. And for one of the problems is that if you haven't had a whole bunch of jobs by that point, you have no idea of what you might enjoy and be well-suited to. So I do think having kids work from an early age is a very good idea.
Matthew B. Crawford is senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies. His new book is called The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. Matthew, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure for me too. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.